So you're all know very well that we're a tradition, a spiritual tradition, that puts a lot of emphasis on the present moment, being present, and a lot of the discovery, a lot of the negotiation, a lot of the struggle in practice has to do with working out those, working with those forces that keep us from being present. So there are many of them. And one of the most common lists for these forces are the five hindrances. So things like desire, aversion, sloth and torpor, restlessness, anxiety, doubt. And but there are other things also that kind of keep us from being present. And so a huge part of the practice is really seeing these things clearly and learning to work with them. And learning to work with them means seeing them clearly. I could probably repeat the words seeing them clearly over and over again, because it's so important to study these things and get to know them well. Sometimes practitioners are dismissive or are in a hurry to get beyond the problems of practice. And I think it's sometimes best not to be in a hurry to get beyond the problems, but to take the difficulties, the struggles of the practice as being the practice, as being the very thing that's probably the most important thing for you to do, is to really get to know something really well. So if desire or aversion or doubt or something is big for you, make it a point to study this. Just not only in meditation practice, but outside of it. Read books about the topic, just talk to friends about the topic. Go for walks on the beach and think about, how it is for you, these things. Journal about it, whatever you can, whatever resources you have to really study these things really well and get to know them well. Because when you get to know something really well, then it's easier to become free of it, know what to do with it. But if you're dismissive of it or get through something quickly, if you let go quickly, the roots of it, the tentacles of it might still be operating, be there ready to jump and ready to ambush you in a moment's notice. And so it's important to study and look at all this. So we're a tradition that emphasizes a lot the present moment, learning to be in the present, to be attentive and mindful. And but I think that it's also very helpful in the practice to have a sense of vision, a sense of what's possible. And maybe that gets kind of shortchanged or not noticed so much, that a sense of vision. Because the intention to practice, the aspiration to practice, the energy we have for practice, has a lot to do with the vision or the sense we have of what the possibility is through the practice. So if we think the purpose of the practice is basically just, to get a little bit of rest because we didn't get enough sleep last night, then, that seems like a worthwhile thing to do, but, you're not going to be so tremendously inspired by that as a goal. But if you felt, you really felt that if you could sit and realize something really deep in your sitting, and it would have a huge impact on the well-being, for the better, for the well-being, for a lot of other people, maybe you'd feel, can galvanize, wow, I can, my life can make a difference. I think I'm going to get, there's a vision of possibility. Or if you have a vision of possibility of, touching some very deep or very dramatic or spiritual dimension of life, somehow touch into that, the not just the sense of faith, but the place of faith, or sense of spiritual sacredness, that might be really inspiring. You have a vision of what's possible. If you have a vision that it's possible, or sense that it's possible to become free of greed, hate, and delusion, and that it's really possible for you. I mean, that's what Buddhism says all the time. So greed, hate, and delusion, I mean, that's nice. And, if I could be a monk or a nun, then maybe I could kind of scratch the surface of that, but that's not for me, and I'm just content to get some rest, or do something simple here, just kind of make my life a little bit better. But if you really felt the possibility, yes, I could do this too, then that would, maybe be much more inspiring. And people can get kind of a lot of fire, a very strong sense of purpose. This is what I'm doing. This is what I want to do. I'm going to do it. As a spiritual tradition that puts a lot of emphasis on the present moment, we often talk also about a lot of accepting the present moment as it is. And that's a very profound teaching, but it can be sometimes at the expense of having of that kind of teaching, that kind of practice, sometimes can put the fire out. You know, we have this fire, this, you know, this great sense of, maybe some people talk about urgency, this great sense of purpose, this great sense of this is what I'm going to do, and I'm going to be committed and resolved, and yes, this is what it's about. And I think that can be a beautiful part of a person's life, to have that. It's a really strong sense of resolve. If it becomes striving, or it's tied to expectation, then a person might suffer a lot. But aspiration is not the same thing as striving. Aspiration is not the same thing as expectation. I think of aspiration as being something that opens us, and is more open-ended, more open to possibilities, than it is something that closes us down. So, for some people, it's very helpful to have some sense of what's possible through the practice. And I know that there are people who, probably most people, the sense of possibility keeps opening and opening, because it's very hard, you know, to have a sense of the full potential of a human being spiritually, unless you can go step by step to kind of experience it. Some people have like near-death experiences, and they have this dramatic kind of experience into some kind of sacred dimension that sometimes blows their socks off. And then they come out of that and they realize, oh, there's this possibility. And then that experience then shows them a path, a direction they can go for their life, and they're forever changed by that. Some people, it's much slower. Some people just feel either tormented by their mind, tormented by their thoughts, and they have some sense that it's possible maybe not to be so tormented. Just that's the vision. And so somehow they practice and the mind settles, and somehow that inner conflict relaxes. And some people feel that's enough. You know, now that part of my life is settled, and I'll go back to my normal life and just take care of things. When I was practicing at San Francisco Zen Center in the 70s, I remember one of the senior teachers telling me that there was a pattern to how people came through Zen Center. And that was, back then there was a lot of young people who came through. They came in their early 20s. And the person told me that a lot of people who come, the first 5 years that they're here, 3 to 5 years they're here, they're just trying to find themselves, find who they are. Find who they are in relationship to society, to other people, and kind of find out who they are. And a community like Zen Center was a great place for people to bump into each other, and they're given jobs and senses of purpose and community and conflict of all kinds. And so you kind of learn all about yourself and get established in various ways. And then this teacher told me, well, after 3 to 5 years, once people find themselves, a lot of people then leave. They kind of did what they wanted to do. They kind of found themselves, they feel somehow settled. And then they go back into the community, they go back to college, or they go back to the work or whatever, and they could do something. And then the interesting thing this teacher said, we shouldn't take him too literally, like he's the, you know, but what he said was, if they stayed after that 3 to 5 year period, that's when they started practicing Buddhism. And So I have some sense of the possibilities. It kind of opens and opens and opens for some people as we go along here. Some people are shy to imagine what's possible for them. They, for some reason, they're self-effacing, or for some reason they feel inadequate, or they feel like it's inappropriate, or they feel like it's maybe egotistical or something, and so they hold back. That's fine, a goal for, you know, the Dalai Lama or some great spiritual teacher, but, you know, I'm just this bumbling fool. Who am I to kind of have some great aspiration? And so some people hold themselves back from even allowing themselves to see, you know, possibility and potential. It's been pointed out that for many years, as psychotherapy developed in America, in the West, it was primarily focusing on pathology and somehow overcoming pathology, psychological problems. And then at some point, maybe with Abraham Maslow, or that there was some idea, let's look beyond pathology. Let's look and see, you know, once a person gets pathology free, you know, kind of an ordinary person, then, you know, are there higher and greater possibilities beyond just simply becoming free of suffering? And it's been pointed out that religions like Buddhism or certain kinds of spiritual traditions are really pointing in that direction. Some people even say that, pointing in that direction, that we're looking at what's possible at kind of the upper end of possibilities. Not just some becoming more accommodating, you know, or fitting into society just well and getting along with our neighbors and, you know, and just being able to cope, but much more than that. So, for each of you, do you have a sense of possibility, a sense of potential, your potential, that maybe is more than the alleviation of suffering? Do you have a sense of a vision of what your spiritual life can lead you to, where you're going? Not everyone does have that. And I'm not saying that people should have that. Some people's spiritual life is not about where they're going or what's happening, but is about how they are in their life. And I know some people who, here in the West sometimes there can be a kind of neurotic attitude around finding your place in life, finding your job, your destiny, the purpose of your life. And some people struggle with that and trying to find what it is. And I've known people for whom a sense of purpose, a sense of the job that they have, their work, their career, or whatever, finding something, was not what their life was about. Their life was about how they lived their life, not what they did. And so it doesn't really matter what, some people have met, it doesn't really matter what they do. They could work any kind of job at all. And sometimes I've met people who worked very humble jobs. But it's how they are is really what inspires them. And that's really where the sense of possibility is. How they are now. Are they kind? Are they generous? Are they compassionate? Are they free? Are they present? That's what their life is about. And maybe there's a sense of possibility there too, you know, possibility of a how. And for other people, a sense of potential and possibility of some direction their life can take is a really important part of who they are. And they see, oh, I can, you know, I could, you know, experience a very deep sense of spiritual peace. I could live a life, there's a possibility that I could be of service to my community. I could engage in my community in some way. And so you might think about it a little bit, you know, how are you? How is it for you? Is vision or potential or sense of possibility something that is useful and wise for you to hold? Is it something you can hold in a more conscious way, in a clearer way? And when you hold it in a more conscious, clearer way, is it something to give fuel to even coming here and practicing on this non-residential retreat? So you're really here, and this, you know, this fits into kind of my sense of potential. I'm going to really try to be present. You have to let go of the potential and vision in the moment of practice, but that vision and possibility can fuel the aspiration. So, okay, I'm really going to engage here in a very, very wholehearted way. You know, I'd be very curious to hear. I probably have not time this week, but I'd be curious to hear from all of you, some point or other, if you have some sense of a potential that you have, or potential the spiritual life has for you, and is that potential something that inspires you or oppresses you? Does it frighten you, or does it have meaning for you, or do you have? Or I'd like to know that you have no sense of potential. You know, that's not something how you operate. You don't think that way. You just like practicing. It just seems to, you feel at home in it. It feels right. And that's enough for you. And it's enough for me too. You know, it doesn't have to be anything more than that. But it's nice to know, nice to be clear about these things. And to know what's what. And then one of the interesting questions, if we have a sense of potential, a sense of possibility, a sense of vision, is what are we willing to do? And what are we willing to let go of to follow through on that? I mean, in some ways, there's an infinite number of potentials within each of us. You know, you could probably all, you all have the potential of becoming better chess players. Right? And you all have, you know, potentials of, you know, memorizing the initials for every television channel there is. Right? No, you don't have the potential? So I went, many years ago, I stayed at someone's house and she said, I have 500 channels. So I went through each channel. I don't think there were 500 because you skipped over whole numbers. But you got to 500 and you started again at one. So we have a lot of potentials. But what are we willing to let go of? What are we willing to put aside so that we can really kind of follow through with some clarity and some emphasis on those things which are really important for us? I think the greater a sense of purpose a person has, the greater is their willingness to let go even of wonderful things so that they can really follow through with that purpose. So it's also in this talk a little bit as an encouragement for all of you to dare to have a vision, dare to have imagine what possibilities can be for you, possibilities for things to be different somehow than what they are, and then in having that sense of possibility, then understanding how the practice of mindfulness, of loving kindness, concentration, the precepts, the paramis, the practices we do, that how that will support going in that direction. That's what's my mind. So, perhaps we can go around the room again and everyone can say their names. Hilda.
Gail.
Nisar. Bill.
Penny.
Sharon.
David.
Kendra.
Anne.
Armand.
Serja.
Pat.
Amy.
Maureen.
Lisa.
Michelle.
Carol.
Smita. Anything anyone wants to bring up, comment or question or concern? Yeah.
You talked about people being shy about potential, but what about being egotistical about potential?
Oh yeah, it's the near enemy. So all these things have traps, and so one of them is to be egotistical. And my hope is that when mindfulness is incorporated into a spiritual practice, that mindfulness will correct for that. Because if the mindfulness is really honest and really careful and really looking carefully, eventually that contraction, that suffering that comes from being egotistical, self-centered, is revealed, shows itself. And then when you see that suffering, then it will become cleansed or cleaned or purified at that point. So I have a lot of faith in the power of the mindfulness practice, so that I don't think necessarily that certain things need to be taken care of right away. I might pick up that someone is egotistical in their practice, but I might not feel the need to say anything about it. It might be not even helpful to say anything, but just let's the practice develop, see, and take its course, and then sooner or later they'll see it. Remember my early sesshins, my early Zen retreats that I had, it was really, I would practice every day at home. I've been practicing for several years by myself. I was practicing, on a daily basis. And I had all kinds of attitudes, understandings about what I was doing in practice, attitudes, understanding of who I was in relationship to the practice. And as long as I practiced, one or two meditation sessions a day at home, the stress or tension, the way that those attitudes were off, didn't show themselves, didn't reveal themselves. But when I went and did it on retreat and practiced, all day long, and then those attitudes started twisting in me, and they were untenable, they were unsustainable in the retreat context because things get intensified. And so it was really valuable for me to be on retreat to see, to have these things become really clear, because I'd gone on for a couple of years without these things, including egotism, showing itself. So retreats are, one place to work with this. But it's not so, so egotism is one thing. There's something which is a form of egotism which is really hard to work with, and that is narcissism. Because that's sometimes very hard to see, and sometimes it's very hard to differentiate between healthy spiritual self-concern and narcissism, because they kind of look the same.
How do you recognize
narcissism? I don't know so much about narcissism, but I've seen people who the whole world centers around them, and everything is referred back to them, and to their needs, their self-image, their self-identity. You see constantly everything's being referred back, and everybody in the world serves that purpose, so that reflection or that support for who they are as a person. And so that probably qualifies as narcissism.
So it sounds like for a narcissistic practitioner, there wouldn't be an avenue open to community and relationships.
Not in a healthy way. I mean, I've known narcissistic people who are very much in community, but they're really kind of in the community in order to kind of have the community support them. That's what they're trying to get. They're getting that from everybody else. Yes?
What's the meaning of narcissistic?
Narcissistic? I don't know. I don't have a good definition beyond what I just said, is that it's excessive preoccupation with oneself and oneself. Narcissus was this Greek guy who saw his reflection, I guess, in the water or in the mirror, and fell in love with himself, and then was completely enamored with himself, and so this kind of way of being self-enamored.
Speaking from my own experience, I find it quite interesting to see my life coming from a child, you build a sense of self. Building blocks, And yet, later on in my life, I found it very useful to destroy them.
Yeah.
It's when I was involved in ego building or developing this concept of self, it's so much burden. When it opens up, you can learn, I can learn so much more things and less fearful things.
Yeah.
So anything that is developing self or ego, I find it very helpful.
On the side of doubt, where one doesn't see oneself as somebody who can do this, I really can identify with that one. I'm going to say that 12 years ago, I forget exactly, but it was my first retreat, and I did not think of myself as somebody who was who could be a meditator, who could aspire to all this. And my teacher, one of them was James Veras, and he told everybody that when he started, never thought that he would be a meditator himself. And it just came right at it was like a stone that fell just into the pool at the right moment, and it just changed.
It freed you up.
It freed me up, yeah.
Great, yeah.
Yeah. And I've heard it from so many other people. It's nice to know we're not alone in that. It's still powerful sometimes in me. It's not over, but...
Sure.
Yeah.
It was very meaningful to me to hear kind of a traditional Zen teaching where they say that all the Buddhas and ancestors meaning the enlightened people before us, at some point in their life they were all like us. And, so they started with the same material. And I'll end with one little story about my practice. Hopefully it's encouraging. So in 1979, I think, I signed up for my first 7-day Zen retreat to Sesshin at the San Francisco Zen Center. It was in the summer. And I'd been practicing Zen for some years, but, I had never sat 1 day of Sesshins, but never sat a 7-day Sesshin. And... No, it was before that. It was 1977. And I signed up to go. And then a week before the Sesshin started, I called up the Zen Center and I said, something really important has come up and I can't come to the Sesshin. They said, okay, we'll take you off the list. And the important thing that came up was fear. So I chickened out of my first retreat. And it was 2 years or a year and a half before I sat my first one after that.
What were you afraid of?
I don't know. Pain. Pain and suffering. So...
I'm the one that's having the problem around here, staying awake. I've meditated for years and whatever, not with this form of Buddhism, but I took this on thinking that this would be fine because I've meditated since I was in my 20s, or since my teens. And I realized Sunday night that I was afraid. And I just sat there and looked into that for a long time, and I just thought that was very strange because it's not been very many times in my life when I've been afraid of anything. And so, unfortunately, in the last 2 days, some of you have noticed that I can't stay awake and I'm making a lot of noise, and I apologize, but...
We can work with it.
I'm deciding, making a decision, hopefully with your permission, to go through this and see if I can get over that terrifying thought of being quiet and thoughtful at the same time, you know?
I understand very well. And
so I'm sorry. Vote every day at noon, whether you want me. I was quiet.
No, you're wanted here. It's fine to be here.
It's very.
And everyone has their own struggles and stuff, and if that's what you're up against, that kind of fear, this is a great place to sit with it. And I've known people who had to sleep for days before they could face something. I've known people who spent a whole week in a retreat crying, and so all kinds of things that go on. I mean, it's you should feel comfortable here. You're not unusual what you're going through.
If you ask, yes, my permission, I say yes, absolutely. And if I can add, all you can do is do the best you can. And your intention is well meant. You didn't mean to interrupt. It's just that's. And I hope it would be better for you.
I was lucky enough to have get a start in my teenage years with a very studied transcendental meditation person who took care of my, feed it into me, and that was a very loving force for a number of years. So
thank you very much for today, and may whatever strength has come from your intention of the day, may it be something that you take with you and to water the seeds of the society around you, so that our goodness here supports others. And a few people could stay behind and do some of the tidying up for a few minutes, that would be greatly appreciated. And Anne is managing today again. And thank you very much.